I want to thank the presenters, and now I'd ask our discussants to come up. And we don't have a set order. Clarence, you are listed first. Polikoff. Okay.
Alex, would you like to go?
Okay, so Alexander Polikoff will kick off the comments.
The organizer, can you hear me all right? The organizers of this conference have been so niggardly in allotting time to discussants that I'm going to divide my few minutes between Jens and Mary, and I hope David won't take it personally. But Joel, you can talk about David. First, a couple of brief observations about MTO. Unhappily, there are aspects of the setup that raise questions about how we ought to think about the results. One of those is that the census data was stale. Jens pointed out that the MTO ran from 94 to 98, but they used 1990 census data. The result was that, and the criterion for move-in with the earmarked vouchers was less than 10% poverty. But by 1994 and through 98, very many of the neighborhoods that were 10% or less poverty in 1990 had become more than 10% poverty. So that you didn't have a true situation of families moving into truly low poverty census tracts across the board of the experimental group. Secondly, there was no racial criterion with respect to the earmarking of the vouchers, as there had been in the Gautreaux case, in the Gautreaux program, so that very many of the neighborhoods that the experimental families moved into were still 100% African-American neighborhoods. I think, if I recall correctly, something like two-thirds of the neighborhoods of the experimental families were predominantly African-American. A third factor, I'm doing this from memory, a third factor was that, as Jens pointed out, even the experimental families who had to move to the supposedly low poverty census tracts tended to cluster as close as they could to where they'd come from. In Chicago, that meant that most of them stayed in the same school district. And very many of those who moved to different school attendance areas continued to send their kids back to the same schools they'd come from before the move. Well, when you aggregate these factors, I think it raises a legitimate question about how to interpret quote, disappointing results from the MTO experiment. I also want to make an observation about the last thing Jen said. He said he looked forward to the 10-year results. These 5-year interim results may not tell us what the long-term trajectory, life trajectory for the people are. And I think that's very true. We ought to look forward with interest to those long-term results. So many of the Jim Rosenbaum Gautreaux results were 7 years or more out. And with respect to children, the longer time frame may be pretty important. Finally, I want to make what I like to call a common sense observation. Jens says, and rightly so, that what we're trying to look at here is the impact that neighborhood has on life chances. And that's an important question, and we ought to learn all we can about that. And I commend all the people who are looking at MTO and other such experimental efforts to try to tease out the implications of neighborhood vis-a-vis people's life chances. But when all is said and done, I'm not a social scientist, so I can say this with a certain degree of legitimacy, i.e. Out of ignorance. There seems to me to be a point here that's being overlooked. That's a common sense point. Jens showed you a picture which he said had a lot of significance for him personally, of those five-year-old kids on the gallery floor with the wall going all the way up, or the chain-link fence going all the way up, prison-like circumstances. And of course that picture is symbolic only of living in neighborhoods rife with crime and drugs and poor role models and unemployment and no males in the family, etc., etc. So ask yourselves from a common sense point of view. Take two kids. One kid spends his her formative years in that kind of an environment. Another kid spends his formative years in a very different kind of environment, where I didn't mention schools as a factor, but where the schools are better, where there's more safety, where there are some people who get up to the alarm clock to go to work in the morning, etc., etc. It's a common sense conclusion I come to that, statistically speaking, the life chances of children who spend their formative years in better neighborhoods are likely to be much greater than the life chances of children who spend their formative years in the environment depicted on Jens's slide. Okay, I have some observations about Mary Patillo's paper. Mary's paper basically makes a three-part case. First part, the legacy of past racism, she says, sustains, these are paraphrases or quotes from the paper, sustains and reproduces contemporary racial disparities, and race doesn't even get mentioned in the process. Instead, she says, fading memories allow current actors to view their actions in non-racial terms, and Mary's example of this is the operation of the courts, and specifically the Gautreaux Court, in North Kenwood Oakland. Second of the three-part case. What is done in this way amounts to recommitting past wrongs by furthering racist aggression in a vicious repetition of systemic racism. The courts, and specifically Gautreaux in MTO, do this by technically narrowing the scope of litigation. And that narrowing permits the exclusion of relevant data. One consequence is that public housing gets rebuilt in black neighborhoods that are already inundated by substantive housing. And the exclusion of data she's referring to, as I know you know who have read the paper, is that the homeowners and other residents in North Kenwood, Oakland, were unable to get the court to listen to the reality of how many, not just hundreds, but thousands of subsidized units saturated North Kenwood, Oakland. That was irrelevant because Gautreaux was a public housing case, and the non-public housing kinds, the non-public housing kinds of subsidized housing didn't count. Well, the third and final part of Mary's case in the paper is that all of what I've just described, the repeat of the vicious and systemic racism that gets propounded, is made possible by posing a false dilemma, namely, should the provision of housing, especially affordable housing, be halted if and when it cannot be provided in a desegregated manner? I wish to advance a somewhat different view of the Gautreaux North Kenwood Oakland history that also coincidentally comes in three parts. First, Gautreaux is a case about non-elderly public housing. Therefore, data about other programs, elderly housing programs, for example, and a variety of non-public housing subsidized programs has been excluded from the court's ambit. What Mary does not discuss in making her data exclusion point is the consequences of allowing the judge in a public housing case to roam through the terrain of other programs, and by implication, a judge in any other kind of a case, civil rights or no, going beyond the parameters of the case. In our system, for a host of non-frivolous reasons, litigation is narrowly confined to the issues to the parties, issues brought by the parties, and it might reasonably be expected that these reasons would be discussed in a critique of the narrowness of litigation. Second of the three parts, Mary omits two important parts of the North Kenwood Oakland history. The first is that Gautreaux was instrumental in forestalling and eventually preventing the rebuilding in NKO of four old Robert Taylor type non-elderly high-rises. This is not an insignificant miscellaneous fact. Rather, it illustrates the deliberate use of litigation to prevent a repetition of the underlying wrong previously identified in the Gautreaux case. And the second and even more important omitted part of the history is that Gautreaux was again used in precisely the way Mary most vigorously criticizes, that is, allowing the building of new public housing, more public housing in a still black neighborhood, through the rubric of the revitalizing area classification. And it was done to achieve exactly the result Mary espouses, namely a dramatic reduction of the total amount of public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland. The rubric was used to bring about the demolition of thousands of public housing units that formerly made up virtually the entire northern border of North Kenwood, Oakland, high-rises included. The demolished units are being replaced with a mixed-income community that includes but is not dominated by public housing and even contains a non-negligible number of market-rate ownership units. Parenthetically, far from having poor memories about race, the parties explicitly pointed out to the judge that they were asking him to convert the part of the Gautreaux remedy that they were then using from a racial to an economic integration vehicle. Finally, because I'm running out of time, the underlying dilemma Mary identifies is not a false one. To the contrary, as Mary herself elsewhere acknowledges, America's history of systemic residential segregation of African Americans persists to this day, among other ways, what Mary calls the unrealizable fantasy of building public housing in a desegregated manner. She's exactly right. It still is an unrealizable fantasy. Given the unhappy reality of persisting residential segregation of African Americans in our society, the achievements of Gautreaux in North Kenwood, Oakland, represent an adroit use of the courts to achieve results that chip away at our society's historic pattern of confining poor African Americans to isolated enclaves of concentrated poverty. Thank you.
It was clear when I got here this morning and realized that Alex was joining me on this panel that the best thing for me to do was to get him first, to get him to go first, and then to suggest that I had nothing else to say and we should move on with Q&A. But let me at least speak to some of the concerns that I have from both the presentations and my and the case that particularly Mary kept presenting, which was either the case for or against public housing. And let me raise the other question is, if not what, as it relates to public housing. My suggestion is that as long as we have minimum wage where it is, as long as we have mortgage funding where it is, and as long as we have credit rules as it relates to individuals' capacity to purchase, what's the alternative? And I think we at some point need to begin to discuss that, and to discuss that also as it relates to what happens in neighborhoods and communities around the city of Chicago and in other places. When one looks at public housing in Chicago and the transformation plan, one has to raise the question as to whether or not we, at the point of housing transformation, did not need a citywide plan to correct all of the problems so that we could have had a plan to correct the public housing issues, a plan to correct the education issues, a plan to correct the housing issues, and some of the health issues at the same time. What we began to do in the transformation of public housing was to tear down public housing, relocate individuals into unwelcoming communities, and oftentimes communities that were more than just unwelcoming, they were hostile, because public housing had done a few other things. It, number one, had allowed for the concentration of poverty in numbers of instances, illiteracy and health issues. It had allowed for, in fact, the stereotyping of a population and the anticipation of that population's moving in created all kind of concerns on the parts of those neighborhoods to which they were going. Without a citywide plan or a full plan of real life transformation, then what we were going to have was some real community squabbles about what was acceptable and what was not. Let me talk a bit from a paper that we did at Hull House in our Public Policy Center. When it established housing supports for low-income individuals and families, the Department of Housing and Urban Development determined that 30% of household budget was appropriate for shelter. That percentage has become a touchstone in the discussion of housing costs and family income. HUD also calculates the fair market rent annually as part of its housing support program based on the median rent for units in the region. Between the year 2000 and 2005, the fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Illinois rose 11.4%. while the median Illinois household income fell 9.8%. During the same period, the portion of Illinois families living in poverty increased from 10.3% to 11.9%. The fair market rate for a two-bedroom apartment in Chicago yesterday was reported to be $935. This morning, the new report suggests the fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Chicago has exceeded $1,000. Remember where our minimum wage is. And so the issue becomes, a worker yesterday had to make $17.98 per hour or work 2.6 full-time jobs at the minimum wage of $6.50 to afford the apartment. That went up this morning. So he's got to get a fourth job and go to a sleep clinic where possible. In Chicago, 34.9% of working poor families who rented paid at least half their income for housing, compared to 2.5% of working families who were not poor. Saying that, the case for public housing or not seems to be very much tied to the notion of minimum wage and income. Now let's talk about the families in this concentrated community of public housing. We're talking about the fact that there are all kinds of issues when we concentrated these people together. The control case spoke of that concentration and the damage done due to that concentration. But if we move the people out, we have expectations. The expectation, of course, is people on their own will move to communities and make different choices for themselves. With low minimum wage, you can't make much of a different choice. You have to go into a community where the people are still very similar, and you move to communities where you have friends, where you have relatives, where you have the institutions that have traditionally supported you. What the destruction of public housing in Chicago did was not just destroy public housing. It destroyed all of the community institutions related to that public housing because they were built to relate to that population. And so if you go in, if you drive down State Street, and you see now, what you see are three churches. Once heavily populated by the tenants, the residents of public housing. Those residents don't come back to those churches. Those churches die, those schools die, the community dies. And so it is not unusual that the people who have moved out into other communities go looking for the support systems that were there for them when they had the other community. They go looking for those systems, and if those systems are not welcoming and are not friendly, what we have created is another community dynamic that we have not yet realized how to treat. What I do think the three presenters this morning led us toward was an understanding of the need of institutional universal standards that we were going to have in all communities, and that we were going to have institutions that worked with the population of people who had been transformed, or people who were in need, so that they would be able to move to communities and truly be a part of the community experience that they are not now a part of because they don't bring with them the skill set to be involved in those new communities. That's a real issue. We do public housing management at Hull House Association. Until a few days ago, and Alex says we threw in the ball and walked away from it, until a few days ago we managed over 800 units of scattered site housing. Scattered site housing, those are the places where people take their Section 8 certificates or they move into an individual home and they are in a new community. The problem that we encountered in most of those communities was that they were unwelcoming communities. Parks didn't want the kids who came from the public housing. Schools didn't want the kids that came from the public housing. The next door neighbors didn't want the kids who came from public housing or the families. Partly because they had stereotypes related to them and they never bothered to get used to them and meet them. The other piece of it was political leaders didn't want them in the neighborhood. The aldermen, the elected officials of any sort. Because the other people in the neighborhood were stronger advocates than were the people who had been moved there from CHA or by CHA. And in the absence of a real voice of advocacy as it relates to the institutions and the survivability in those neighborhoods, they were not welcome. And so the political powers, the political leadership was not there in support of the community. And so what you have in fact, I think, are two questions. One question, if not public housing, what? And the other question is how do we come to grips with the need for a Chicago-wide plan to deal with all of the issues on the table as a result of our demolition of public housing. And all of that does not relate just to public housing. And then finally, how do we create, and I think this is a challenge to SSA, how do we create the institutional standards that we expect, and how do we then offer the counseling and the clinical supports and all of the other supports to families who have been moved into communities that are unwelcoming and communities that do not welcome them? How do we create the communities, and how do we establish the standards and implement those standards so that people move towards self-sufficiency and that communities thrive? Thank you.
But what I'd like to do is really put a little context to David's remarks about the new communities program and what's going on in the 16 communities affected by that initiative. Because I think it's important to keep in perspective the notion that as these communities are working to improve themselves through a comprehensive approach, it really is in reaction to a long history of initiatives that in some cases worked, but by and large did not. And I think it's important to remember, again, keeping history in mind, that for many years, the largest and most abundant tool that we had to fix up communities was something called the low-income housing tax credit that came about in response to organizing efforts around community disinvestment in Chicago neighborhoods and in neighborhoods around the country. And it was a case where the largest number of resources that we had available in many communities came through low-income housing tax credits. So groups like LISC and others around the country and neighborhoods throughout Chicago and around the country used it to provide more affordable housing in communities. And for many years in the 1980s and 90s, there were thousands and thousands of affordable housing units that were built through that program in communities around the country. In the mid-90s, though, many of us began to see that while affordable housing units were being built, neighborhoods in many cases were not getting better. And that, in fact, a comprehensive approach was required. That, in fact, neighborhood environments really do affect in large measure the people, the choices and chances of people who live in those communities. And that we have to look at our communities through a broader perspective. Housing is critical, it is essential, it is necessary, but it is not sufficient. And therefore, LISC in the late 90s convened a group called the Futures Forum to look at different approaches and came to the conclusion that we were going to embark on a comprehensive approach to community development. Began a pilot project in the late 90s in three communities, as David mentioned, which grew with the support of the MacArthur Foundation into the 16 communities that we are working on now in the seventh year of a 10-year initiative. Now, David talked about some of the C grants, some of the programs, some of the investment that has been leveraged through that program, and it is true that all that has happened, and I think there are some exciting results happening in these communities. But as important to me and to many of us working in this program is that it's not simply about the production of units or the production of commercial space or the number of projects that get done or necessarily the leverage that comes out of a seed grant. As important is that what is happening is that a platform is being created for investment in these communities, which is attracting support, it's building relationships in these communities, and it is rebuilding the neighborhood infrastructure in these communities, rebuilding the social fabric of these communities. One of my favorite politicians right now, a fellow by the name of Barack Obama, talks about change coming from the top down and the bottom up. And I think that's right. The New Communities Program is about the bottom up part of that equation. It is about the ability of a community to withstand shocks. it is critical as we think of this program not to think of it as a program simply of projects, but it is about creating the infrastructure, rebuilding the networks and the relationships that help make any community successful. It is about the information flows in a neighborhood, so people in that community know what's going on, know what the resources are, come together around a common vision, and are able to implement that vision because they have those strong relationships. One of our best examples from the program was in the Southwest Chicago community of Chicago Lawn, where when they began their quality of life planning project, the first thing they did was interview 100 leaders in their community in one-on-one sessions. They held a community meeting following. They invited those 100 leaders. 150 people RSVP'd and 250 people showed up. Those people then began to interact around common visions, and then they began to implement solutions for those communities. So it's rebuilding those networks and relationships and creating the information flows that result in trust, result in common visions, and then programs that can eventually be implemented and create some success. Now, as we've been doing this work over the last 6 or 7 years, we've learned a little ourselves in the process. And we think about it and talk about it in a little different way. We used to say that this sort of comprehensive community development work really begins with quality of life planning, where people come together and identify not just housing, but commercial development, education, sports, recreation, safety, and arts and culture, and all of the elements that go into making up a healthy community. And it is about that, but it is more than about that. It is about engagement. It is about community engagement. So what we say to folks today is that it's about building that strong sense of relationships in the communities so that you can come up with the plans and you can then use that engagement to leverage resources, build relationships to produce more results in each of these communities. We also say, though, that the engagement is only the first part of that, because engagement only goes so far. The second part is really putting together what we've come to call a thoughtful consensus-building covenant. It's cutting the deal in the neighborhood. When I was a community organizer, that was in the old days, he said, that's cutting the deal. It's saying to each other, all right, we've got these common visions. What are you going to do? What are we going to do? How do we make sure that everything that has to get done gets done? And then making that deal and taking responsibility for making sure that every single element of a local plan is being done or is being worked on, and that there is that accountability factor built in. So it's building that consensus-building covenant within a community so that there is this agreed-upon division of responsibilities around that collective vision. And thirdly, we also say that it's about creating the political center. Because local stakeholders have to be engaged. But to accomplish plans and to accomplish substantial neighborhood change, it takes a broad consensus. It takes a concentration of political will. And so the fringe ideas fall by the wayside, or if you spend lots of time working on them, they just don't get implemented. But if you can identify projects and visions and ideas that can create that political center, that can attract enough support from a broad cross-section of the community and of the political actors and of the private sector and others, then you can begin to make a lot of good things happen in a community in a short amount of time. It's also about documenting and communicating the work, because so much of what goes on in local communities is thankless, it's quiet, it's unknown, it's not understood, and it's not accepted. And so we as people working and changing local communities, we have to constantly work at getting the word out about what's being done and how it's being done and who's involved, and grow that base of knowledge and awareness about some of the successes and the failures, the things that are working and not working. In our program, one of the key elements we feel of the success that we're seeing is the fact that we have a set of urban journalists who are out working in the neighborhoods, reporting on everything that's going on, putting it on the website, putting it out in documentation, so that we can analyze and assess on a real-time basis when things are working and when they're not. So that when there's a shooting in one of our communities and there's a community meeting that goes till 11 o'clock at night, we've got a report on our desk in the next morning at 7:30 in the morning, telling us what's going on, who's doing it, and who needs to come together to address the issues that are important in that neighborhood to turn around unfavorable activity in that community. And it is about building a depth of leadership in these communities so that there is a group of folks who understand the dynamics of their neighborhood, who have the respect of each other in their community, and who are able to implement programs and initiatives on a large scale. It is about making sure that is not just resting in one individual or in one small organization, but that there is a group of partners cutting across neighborhoods and cutting across issues who are working together around a unified vision and who are working together to make the kind of change that's necessary in order to turn our communities around and to have them improve and to really produce the kind of results that are envisioned in these broad-reaching quality of life plans. Those are the principles upon which our work is based. We're seeing some pretty good success, although we don't really consider it a model. We consider it an approach that is an experiment in progress, that is something that is showing really good signs, but that is beginning to give us the kind of feedback we see to continually improve, to get more and more engagement and more results so that our neighborhoods continue to improve across the board. Thank you very much.
This question is directed to Professor Ludwig. I want to thank Mr. Wood for articulating very strongly the imperative that we move away from this, what I would call a false dichotomy between place-based and people-based approaches, because obviously we have to do both. And so my question concerns the research. Is there research about the effectiveness of a combined approach that enables people to move from exclusively low income into more mixed income communities, but with an enhanced level of social supportive services, and whether we see different outcomes that way, which then says something about what we want to do for provision of services.
Yeah, I think the one answer is that MTO, to some degree, aspired to provide additional supports for movers beyond what we normally do with part of the housing voucher program. So, for instance, I was living in Washington, D.C. when I started working on MTO, and so I did a lot of site visits to the Baltimore MTO site. And I families there, for starters, went through something on the order of 15 to 20 hours worth of life skills counseling before they relocated, including things like how to balance a checkbook. I found myself scribbling frantically during that session. How to take care of a yard, how to negotiate with the landlord, so on and so on. So there was a lot more. So that's much more intensive than what we normally typically do in U.S. cities for movers. And then there was a little bit of follow-up assistance, maybe not as much as one might ideally like in retrospect, but certainly much more what you might think of as aftercare compared to the standard Section 8 voucher program. I think in retrospect, when you look at the results, and I would not characterize myself, the MTO results, as disappointing so much as complicated. When you look at the MTO results in retrospect, one might wonder whether more intensive aftercare might have made the results less complicated. But my own reading of the social science literature is that we don't have as crisp an answer to the question that you're asking as we would like. But it is a really important question, because I think that's a natural place to go as you think about how we might make the voucher program work even better for low-income families.
Maybe if we get by without that, let's see. This is a question for David and the researcher, and for Joel as a practitioner. There were a few cases in the list in the new program where you had to invent can you talk about the differences in any that you saw between those situations and one where you picked the fully developed positions?
Well, I'll be interested to hear David's observations from afar on this, but there were several instances. There is a lead agency in each of these 14 communities, and in several communities there was no one lead agency that had been widely respected and that had the ability to convene all the players in that community. And so in a couple cases, new agencies were created, or coalitions of existing groups were created to form a new organization. It created some real challenges because a whole new set of relationships had to be built among the existing players. In the Mid-South area, where the alderman was the one person who was not only widely respected but had the ability to bring everyone to the table, she convened a new group which became the Quad Communities Development Corporation. Several years into the program, it is running very successfully. It's been able to bring people to the table. It is an example, though, of a group which coordinates, convenes, and facilitates lots of work by a lot of different players in the community rather than doing a lot of it themselves. They've limited what they do themselves, and they didn't come in with a long history of capacity. So it's a different kind of a role than, for example, in Chicago Lawn, where there's a 35-year-old agency, which is the lead organization in that community, which is doing active work itself, but who also then brought in other partners. So it's been a slower startup in some of those communities, but we've seen some pretty good results. Englewood is another community where a new organization was created because there had not been one organization in place that was widely respected and had been accepted as a place where everyone would come to the table. Slower startup, but through that long term, and if you take the time to get everyone together and do the necessary organizing and do it appropriately, then people can begin to build the trust. We use our seed grants to help build that trust, to help support people working together to build those relationships. Then you can see that kind of success. David, do you want to add to that?
Sure. Three quick observations about these groups that were newly created in Quad Communities, also in Englewood. The first is that sort of swamping the qualitative data on this is observations about how hard it is to run NCP through a small organization. NCP funds two staff people, essentially, and so organizations that had to run the planning process and also manage implementation found it literally challenging, you know, the long hours, and were less able to rely on the sort of organizational infrastructure that was created through other projects. This is not to say that they were less successful than other organizations, with Quad Communities being one of the groups that actually produced the most leverage. The second observation is that context really does matter in this. And just on the Quad Communities case, a lot of the political alignment that was discussed earlier within that neighborhood made the job of the intermediary a lot easier, and that it could rely on other organizations with a very concrete vision for community change that supported creating a more mixed income neighborhood there, and therefore was able to try to set the groundwork for a lot of investments. And the third is that all these new groups that we've studied have felt pressures to become sort of standing organizations that do things, in addition to their sort of planning and intermediary responsibilities, with both Quad Communities and Englewood sort of exploring ways of sort of moving into the development realm, probably because of their relationship with LIS, but also because of wanting to form a sort of identity in the community.